Welcome to Fight the Good Fight, a production of Freedom Force Florida. And now your hosts, Michael Williams and Tabitha Brown.
Hey everyone, welcome to another deep dive.
Yeah, welcome back.
Today we're going to be looking at how brain development and childhood trauma kind of play a role in how our justice system works.
That's fascinating stuff.
Yeah, so we have a few different sources we're going to be pulling from today. An analysis of brainwaves, a man's personal life story, and an action plan from an organization that he founded.
And we're going to be focusing all of this through the lens of one particular case, a man named Randy Baggett.
Perfect. Okay. So I guess the place to start then is with brainwaves.
Sure.
So brainwaves are, they're basically electrical pulses in your brain.
Okay.
They're like a symphony of activity.
Uh-huh.
And just like an orchestra, you know, it has different sections, your brain has different types of brainwaves.
I see.
We call these delta, theta, alpha, beta, and gamma.
Mm-hmm.
And each one kind of dominates at different points in your life.
So it's like our brains are playing different tunes as we age.
Exactly. Yeah, that's a great way to put it.
So tell me more about that.
Okay, well, as a baby, you know, delta waves are the most prominent.
Uh-huh.
And that's when you have deep sleep.
Mm-hmm.
You have really heavy brain growth.
Oh.
Then in early childhood,
yeah,
theta waves come into play when you're awake.
Okay.
And this is when you see kids, like, you know, daydreaming.
Right, right, yeah.
Their imaginations just run it wild.
Yeah.
And what's fascinating is that during this phase, children are incredibly receptive to information.
That's so true, yeah.
It's like, you know, their brains are sponges. They're just soaking everything up.
That's why it's so easy for them to, you know, believe in things like Santa Claus, right?
Exactly, yeah.
But it makes you wonder, though.
Yeah.
You know, kids aren't always great at critical thinking.
Right.
So what happens when they absorb information that's maybe not so true?
That's a great point.
Yeah.
And it's one of the things that really makes you think about, you know, these early experiences.
Yeah.
The ones that, you know, we might not even remember consciously, they become ingrained in our subconscious.
Wow.
And they shape our core beliefs about the world and about ourselves.
Okay.
And here's the thing.
Yeah.
This wiring continues to influence us as adults.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
It impacts how we behave, how we react, even how we see ourselves.
Okay, so let's bring Randy into the picture here.
Okay.
Our sources give us a really clear picture of what his childhood was like.
Yeah.
He grew up in a very traditional Southern family.
Uh-huh.
The kind where family is everything.
Yeah.
But it was also a very patriarchal environment.
Hmm.
Randy, being the oldest son,
mm-hmm.
was constantly told he was the man of the house. Yeah, the protector
mm-hmm.
of his mother
uh-huh.
and his younger siblings.
So, you know, imagine young Randy
yeah.
in that theta state.
Yeah.
Just soaking up those words
yeah.
like a sponge.
Mm-hmm.
His whole identity is forming around this concept of duty and protection.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And it's highly probable that those messages went straight into his subconscious.
Okay.
And became, you know, a fundamental part of his belief system.
So these early beliefs can have a lasting impact.
Absolutely, yeah.
Wow.
And to add another layer to this,
okay.
Randy's father was a Mason, you know, heavily involved in this culture.
Yeah.
That stressed loyalty and secrecy.
Mm.
You know, sources suggest that Randy was practically raised.
Yeah.
With the idea that family matters were kept behind closed doors.
Oh, wow. So we've got this young boy.
Yeah.
His brain is in that super absorbent theta state. He's being told that he's responsible for protecting his family.
Yeah.
And that whatever happens at home stays at home.
Exactly.
I can already see how this might have set the stage.
Yeah.
For, you know, some difficulties down the line.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, that kind of environment combined with this constant pressure of being the man of the house.
Yeah.
It could have made it incredibly difficult for Randy to reach out for help. Or even just to express his emotions.
Right.
And this becomes especially critical.
Yeah.
As we move into Randy's adolescence.
Yeah. Okay.
A time when, you know, the brain is going through these major changes.
Yeah, those teenage years.
Yeah. But those crucial decision-making skills are still developing.
Right.
And to make things even more complicated.
Yeah.
Things at home were far from stable.
Okay.
When Randy was 13,
mm-hmm.
his parents divorced.
Okay.
Which, you know, that's already a tough thing for any kid to go through.
Yeah.
But then his mom married her uncle.
Wow. Her uncle.
Yes.
Wow. That adds a whole other layer of complexity to an already delicate situation.
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And to make matters worse, the marriage is incredibly troubled.
Yeah.
Randy witnesses his stepfather, who is also his great uncle, being physically abusive towards his mother and younger brother.
Given everything we've learned about brain development, I can only imagine the impact this must have had on Randy, especially with that protector role already so deeply ingrained in his psyche.
It's heartbreaking to think about. Here he is, a teenager, trying to navigate the already tumultuous waters of adolescence, and he's thrust into this environment where he feels responsible for his family's safety, but he's powerless to stop the abuse.
And we have to remember that the adolescent brain is still developing during this time.
Absolutely.
It's a period of intense change and vulnerability.
The prefrontal cortex, which is crucial for impulse control and rational decision making, isn't fully mature until the mid-20s.
Oh, wow.
So you have this perfect storm of hormonal shifts, emotional turmoil, and a developing brain trying to cope with incredibly stressful and traumatic situations.
Right.
This brings up some important legal questions, too, as the research cited in Roper v. Simmons, the case that abolished the death penalty for juveniles, highlights just how crucial this understanding of brain development is when it comes to the justice system.
Okay, so we have this foundation of Randy's childhood and the significant challenges he faced during his teenage years, what eventually led to the confrontation with his stepfather.
Well, after witnessing yet another incident of abuse, Randy, driven by that deep-seated sense of responsibility and likely fueled by a surge of anger and impulsivity, gets into a physical altercation with his stepfather.
Okay.
Tragically, the fight ends with Randy killing him.
It's a truly tragic outcome in such a complex situation.
Yes.
Of course, we're not condoning Randy's actions in any way.
Of course not.
But it is crucial to understand the context of his brain development and the trauma he experienced to grasp the full complexity of this case.
I agree. Randy's story raises challenging questions. To what extent should these factors, brain development and trauma, be considered within the justice system, especially when dealing with juvenile offenders?
Right.
How much weight should be given to those formative experiences when determining guilt and punishment?
It's a really thought-provoking point, and I'm sure we'll delve deeper into that as we continue exploring Randy's story. But for now, let's move on to what happened after his conviction.
Okay.
His life takes some unexpected turns, right?
It does indeed. His journey after the conviction is surprisingly complex and full of twists. We'll explore those next. Randy's story doesn't just end with his conviction.
Oh, okay.
It actually gets a lot more complicated.
Oh, really?
His time in prison has been kind of a mix of challenges and remarkable efforts towards rehabilitation.
It seems like that's what's so interesting about this whole case, is it really challenges our assumptions about what the criminal justice system is and what the potential for change is within that system.
Yeah.
So what were some of the challenges that he faced during his time?
Well, he actually escaped a few times early on.
Oh, wow.
In his sentence. And there were quite a few disciplinary reports.
What for?
A lot of them stem from romantic relationships with female corrections officers.
It makes you wonder if that's him still seeking connection.
Right.
And kind of pushing the boundaries, but within this new set of rules in the prison system.
Yeah.
If those deep-seated needs, maybe stemming from his chaotic childhood, were still driving his behavior, even in this very controlled environment.
It's possible.
Yeah.
And it really kind of highlights the very complex nature of rehabilitation.
Uh-huh.
It's not just about offering educational opportunities or therapy.
Yeah.
You know, it's about addressing those underlying emotional needs and helping individuals develop healthier coping mechanisms and ways of connecting with others.
That makes sense. But how do you even begin to do that in a system that often feels like it's more focused on punishment than rehabilitation?
It's a huge challenge, and it's something a lot of experts are struggling with right now.
Yeah.
There is a growing recognition that we need a more holistic approach, one that considers an individual's developmental history,
okay,
their trauma, their psychological needs.
And this raises, I think, a crucial question.
Yeah.
What does true remorse look like?
Hmm.
Our sources point to a significant moment in Randy's journey.
Okay.
One that happened when he turned 45.
Uh-huh.
The same age his stepfather was when he died.
Why?
It was at this point that Randy seemed to fully grasp the magnitude of his crime.
Hmm.
And he began to express, you know, genuine empathy for his victim.
Yeah.
Recognizing, you know, the life he had taken and the pain he caused.
That's powerful. And, you know, this shift towards empathy is often a pivotal turning point in the rehabilitation process.
Yeah.
It signifies a move beyond self-pity and an acceptance of the lasting consequences of one's actions.
And this brings us back to the Howard v. Coonrod case, right?
Yes.
Which is challenging Florida's parole system for juvenile offenders.
Exactly.
To refresh our memories, can you kind of explain what that case is about and why it's so important?
Sure. So imagine you're sentenced to life in prison as a teenager.
Okay.
This case argues that Florida's current parole system doesn't really give people like you, people who committed crimes as juveniles, a fair chance to show that they've changed and deserve to be released.
Okay.
It basically claims that the system doesn't adequately consider the potential for rehabilitation.
So it's not just about the crime itself.
Yeah.
It's about recognizing that young people have a greater capacity for change and growth.
Exactly.
Like their brains are literally still developing, and they might not have had the same level of impulse control or decision-making abilities as adults when they committed the crime.
That's right. And this case challenges that notion that a sentence handed down to a juvenile should essentially be a life sentence.
Okay.
Regardless of their rehabilitation efforts.
We've seen similar cases like this in other states, haven't we?
Yeah, in states like Iowa and Massachusetts, courts have ruled in favor of juvenile offenders in similar cases, acknowledging that young people's brains are still developing and that they have a greater potential for rehabilitation than adults.
It sounds like a real turning point in how we approach juvenile justice as a society.
It could be.
Getting back to Randy's case specifically, though,
yeah.
How might the outcome of Howard v. Coonrod affect his future? Could it potentially open up a path for his release?
It is a possibility if the court finds that Florida's parole system is unconstitutional.
Okay.
It could lead to changes in how parole decisions are made for juvenile offenders.
Right.
It might require more individualized assessments and a greater consideration of rehabilitation efforts.
So someone like Randy, right, who has dedicated himself to personal growth education and even founded an organization focused on reform, might have a stronger case.
Exactly.
For demonstrating that he's ready to be reintegrated into society.
Right. It's not about excusing the crime,
uh-huh,
but it's about acknowledging the potential for transformation and allowing for a pathway back into society for those who have shown genuine remorse and who have taken concrete steps towards rehabilitation.
It sounds like we are on the verge of a pretty big shift,
yeah,
in how we approach criminal justice.
Yeah.
Kind of moving away from this purely punitive model towards a system that recognizes the possibility of rehabilitation and second chances.
It's an exciting but also challenging time.
Yeah.
There are a lot of difficult conversations that need to happen, and it'll require a collective effort,
right,
to create a system that is both just and compassionate.
But Randy's story and cases, yeah, like Howard v. Coonrod,
yeah,
really highlight the importance of having these conversations and rethinking our assumptions, mm-hmm, about crime punishment and the human capacity for change.
Exactly.
It's definitely complex, you know?
Yeah.
On the one hand, we want to hold people accountable for their actions,
right,
and ensure public safety. But on the other hand, we want to recognize that there is this possibility of redemption,
okay,
and create a system that allows for second chances.
It's a tough balance.
It's a delicate balance, for sure.
And this is where the science of brain development and the understanding of trauma become so crucial.
Sure.
They provide really valuable insights into why people commit crimes and how they can change.
Right.
It's not about making excuses, but it's about trying to understand the underlying factors that contribute to criminal behavior.
Yeah.
And using that knowledge to develop more effective interventions and ultimately create a justice system that truly promotes rehabilitation.
Randy's story really embodies this complexity so well.
Yeah.
You know, he committed a terrible crime, but he's also made significant strides towards rehabilitation.
Right.
And he hasn't just focused on his own personal growth. He's actively working to change the system that incarcerated him.
It's pretty amazing.
It's truly inspiring.
His work with Freedom Force Florida really speaks volumes about his character.
Yeah.
And his commitment to making amends for his past actions. It's a powerful testament to the human capacity for growth and change.
This entire deep dive has really opened my eyes to the nuances of the justice system.
Yeah.
And the impact of trauma.
Right.
And this incredible potential for transformation, even in the face of really difficult adversity.
It's been thought-provoking, hasn't it?
Yeah.
We've explored the science. We've talked about Randy's personal story.
Right.
And we've grappled with some of the most fundamental questions about justice and redemption.
And as we move into the final part of our deep dive, I'm really curious to explore more about Freedom Force Florida and what it really represents.
Yeah.
Could it be a manifestation of those deeply ingrained beliefs about responsibility and protection that we talked about earlier?
It's an interesting question, and one that I think we should definitely delve into further in part three.
Welcome back to our deep dive, everyone, where we've been exploring brain development, trauma, and the justice system all through the lens of Randy Bagot's life.
It's been a really fascinating discussion.
Yeah, we've covered so much already, the world of brainwaves, early childhood experiences, and even what rehabilitation looks like in the prison system.
Right. And now I think we should really dig into the next chapter of Randy's story.
Okay.
We left off talking about Freedom Force Florida.
Yeah, the organization that he actually founded while he was still incarcerated.
Right.
I want to hear more about that and what it reveals about his transformation.
Freedom Force Florida is really quite remarkable.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a real testament to Randy's commitment to creating positive change.
Okay.
They got some pretty bold ideas about how to shift things.
Yeah, what's fascinating is that they're not just advocating for, like, tweaks, you know,
yeah,
to the existing system.
Right.
They're talking about a pretty fundamental change in how we think about justice.
I think so, yeah.
Like justice itself.
To understand what they're proposing, we've got their detailed plan for reform.
Okay.
Plus some of their own analysis comparing the two main philosophies
right.
of the justice system.
Makes sense.
Rehabilitation versus retribution.
Big question.
Yeah. We'll unpack all of that. And you might even find some surprising facts.
Okay.
About how Florida's system got to where it is today.
It's a really interesting journey because it reflects a larger trend.
Yeah.
We've seen across the U.S.
Right. Like this one fact that blew my mind.
Okay.
Back in 1978, Florida actually renamed its entire prison system.
Wow.
It went from the Department of Offender Rehabilitation to the Department of Corrections.
Wow. So they just straight up changed the name.
Yeah. I mean, just think about the shift in thinking that represents.
It's a powerful symbol of how the focus moved away from the idea of reforming offenders
right.
and towards a more punitive approach.
Yeah.
And this was happening all over the country in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah.
During that tough on crime era.
Totally. So decades later, along comes Freedom Force Florida saying, hold on, let's reconsider this whole retribution thing.
Interesting.
And their plan is to tackle this on multiple fronts, but they're starting with some
Makes sense.
Specific new laws.
This is where the rubber meets the road, you know?
Yeah.
It's one thing to have good intentions. It's another to turn that into legislation that can make a real difference.
Absolutely. So let's dive into these laws.
Okay.
The first one that caught my eye is called the Mercy for Children Act.
Oh, okay.
It's all about giving reformed juvenile offenders a real second chance.
Think about it this way. Laws change over time.
Right.
But people who were sentenced under the old laws, they can get stuck.
Mm-hmm.
The Mercy for Children Act aims to change that by making the 2014 juvenile sentencing statutes retroactive.
Okay.
Giving those who've, you know, turned their lives around
a
chance to benefit from a more rehabilitative approach.
That makes sense. And then you've got the RISE Act,
okay,
which focuses on mandatory work release for inmates during the final stages of their sentences.
The idea here is to smooth the transition back into society.
Yeah.
It's not enough to just punish someone for a crime.
You
have to give them the tools and support
to
build new life. And having work experience can be crucial.
Totally.
For that.
Okay, so that's two.
Uh-huh.
What's next on their list?
The Compassionate Release Act.
Okay.
This one's about giving judges more flexibility to modify sentences.
Okay.
For inmates who are terminally ill or have severe disabilities.
Right.
Freedom Force Florida argues that this is not only about humane treatment,
right,
but also about saving the state money
yeah.
on healthcare costs.
Right.
within the prison system.
Right, because keeping someone who is terminally ill in prison
right.
doesn't really serve anyone, does it?
Exactly. It's about recognizing that justice requires taking individual circumstances into account.
And along those lines, there's the Elderly Inmate Release Act.
Yep.
This one tackles the fact that Florida, like much of the U.S.,
yeah.
has an aging prison population.
Right.
This act would allow inmates aged 50 or older who have served at least 10 years of their sentence and have 10 or more years remaining
okay.
to petition the court for a sentence modification.
Makes sense.
Think about it. The risks and needs of an older inmate are often very different.
Yeah.
From those of a younger one.
Right.
And from what I've read, it's incredibly expensive.
It is.
To care for elderly inmates, so there's also a cost-benefit analysis here.
Absolutely. Freedom Force Florida argues that keeping someone who poses a minimal threat
right.
to public safety locked up for decades at great expense just doesn't make sense.
So we've got four acts down, one to go.
Okay.
What's the last one they're pushing for?
The Civil Commitment Referrals Act.
Okay.
This one focuses on mental health,
okay.
requiring evaluations for individuals exhibiting persistent antisocial behavior.
So instead of automatically defaulting to prison,
yeah.
they're saying, let's see if there are underlying mental health issues
exactly.
that might be contributing to the behavior.
It's about getting to the root of the issue.
Yeah.
Freedom Force Florida believes that intervening early with mental health support
uh-huh.
could potentially prevent crimes and save both the individual yeah. and society a lot of suffering.
You know, when I first started looking into Freedom Force Florida,
yeah.
I thought they were just focused on changing laws.
Oh.
But it seems like they're aiming for something much bigger.
You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
They want to transform the entire approach to corrections in Florida.
Yeah.
And that's a much heavier lift. It's pretty amazing to think about, you know,
yeah.
a man who has spent decades behind bars fighting for the rights of other people in similar situations. So it makes you wonder if Randy's involvement with Freedom Force Florida is a way for him to channel those feelings of responsibility and protection that were so deeply ingrained in him from his childhood.
That's a really interesting point.
Yeah.
I mean, remember how he was raised to be the man of the house, to be the protector?
Right.
Well, maybe Freedom Force Florida is a way for him to live out those values, but now in a way that helps a much larger community.
Yeah. It's like instead of just protecting his immediate family, he's now fighting for the rights and well-being of all these people impacted by the justice system.
Exactly. And it's such a powerful example of how our early experiences and all those messages that we internalize can shape our paths in life. But it also shows how those same influences can be redirected towards positive change.
There are so many layers to Randy's story, and it just keeps raising all of these really profound questions about justice redemption and the potential for transformation.
Absolutely. It's a story that makes us confront our own beliefs about the criminal justice system
yeah.
and grapple with how complex human behavior really is.
It forces us to ask ourselves, you know, can people really change?
Right.
Do people who have committed serious crimes deserve that second chance?
Tough questions.
There are no easy answers to that. There's no one-size-fits-all solution.
Definitely not.
Each case is unique, and we have to consider the individual circumstances, the impact of any trauma, and their potential for rehabilitation.
And as we learn more about the brain,
right.
about how our experiences shape our development and our behavior, we can hopefully start to approach these questions with more understanding.
You know, Randy's dedication to personal growth
yeah.
and his work with Freedom Force Florida are truly inspiring.
They are. It's really powerful to see. You know, his story encourages us to look beyond the crime.
Yeah.
To really see the individual and to always remember that redemption is possible.
This deep dive has really given me a new perspective on the criminal justice system as a whole.
I'm glad.
And just the complexities of human behavior and the power of hope and second chances.
It's really what it's all about.
I hope that our listeners have found this deep dive as thought-provoking as I have.
I hope so too.
You know, Randy Baggett's story really shows us that while we don't always have control over our circumstances, we always have the power to choose how we respond to them.
Right. We can either let negativity and despair win.
Yeah.
Or we can choose to learn to grow and to become agents of positive change.
Thank you all for joining us today. And we encourage you to continue exploring these really complex issues, to have those open and honest conversations about justice and redemption, and to always embrace the transformative power of second chances.
Thank you for listening to Fight the Good Fight. Please join us by signing up on our website and help fund our mission by clicking the donate page.